to Tuned to Yesterday, broadcasting programs from radio's past. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Coming up in this hour, horror. Later on, two different stories from Nelson Olmsted's series, Sleep No More. But first, an episode of The Haunting Hour called Revenge, number 26 in the syndicated series from 1945.
Moment. For this is a time of mystery, a time when imagination is free and moves forward swiftly, silently. This is The Haunting Hour. Listen, those are bells tolling in requiem for a man who has died. How did he die, you ask? Ah, listen to what happened to a girl who knew and whose mind was clouded dark with the fear of knowing. Listen to a tale of murder. It is late afternoon. Lee House is set strangely on a cliff beside the rolling sea. Autumn leaves fall, and with them the threads of night. And in a car, parked a little distance from the house at a pillared gate, sits a girl behind the wheel. Beside her stands an old man with sad and beguiling eyes.
It's a bad night, Miss Anna, to be driving the sea road.
I know, Jameson, but I must go, I must. How could I spend another night in that house? What could be keeping him?
This young man, Miss Anna, is he...
He's a good driver, Jameson. I'll be perfectly safe.
I do hope you will be, ma'am. Listen, you can hear the surf from here. How Mr. Jonathan loved the sea.
Jameson, don't. Oh, there's rain behind that wind, I bet.
Annabelle! Annabelle!
It's in my mind. The memory of him. I can still see him. Like that night a few weeks before he died. I mustn't think of it. Not now. Not now.
You can't forget me, Annabelle. Even when I'm dead, I'll live in your mind. I'll feed on your fear of my ghost.
I'd rather be dead. Jonathan, let me out of this house. Let me go.
My dear, you're too lovely for others to see. So I've no choice but to keep you within these walls.
Within this prison, you mean? Even that chauffeur is a spy. There isn't a moment of the day when I don't feel a pair of eyes watching everything I do. They even pry into my thoughts. Jonathan, if you have any kindness in your heart...
Look here. Here at the window. The ocean is white-capped. Far you can see.
Why do you torture me? How can you hate me so much?
I don't, my Annabelle. And this pleading, it's no use. You'll never forget me. I'll never let you go. I'll never let you go.
Miss Anna, why so pensive?
Oh, I was thinking. Remembering. Jameson, are you sure you want to be caretaker at Lee House? You won't be lonesome?
I wouldn't leave it, Miss Anna. It'd be like leaving my little girl, my daughter Amy.
You loved her very much, didn't you?
That I did. And the morning we found her, at the bottom of the cliff down there in the cove, was almost more than my heart could bear. But that was long ago. Look there. Reckon that's the young man coming now.
Oh, yes, it is. Goodbye, Jameson. You've been a good friend. Thank you for that. Goodbye.
Good luck, Miss Anna, wherever you go.
Jim. Oh, Jim, I thought you'd never come.
Hello, Anna. Sorry.
Here, climb in here. Take the wheel.
Okay. A few last things to do at the Hendersons. You know how it is.
Jim, hold me close.
I'm so worried. I'm afraid you might think I wasn't coming. And all the time running over that hill, my heart kept pounding, saying, Simpleton Jim Brandt, even late for his elopement. Well, ready to start, Mrs. Brandt? Just you wait and see what a swell honeymoon trip I've got planned for us, Mrs. Brandt.
Oh, so wonderful. But is it real, Jim?
What do you mean, real? Of course it's real.
Seems like a good dream. After the last 3 months since he died, I've lived in a nightmare since then.
Oh, but it's over now.
Over and done with. Jim, don't think me silly, but they don't exist any longer, do they?
Hmm?
I mean, people who are dead.
My heavens, no. Except in somebody's mind, maybe. Somebody who was close. A wife or a daughter like you, maybe. Especially a good-looking daughter like you.
Yes. I want to tell you something, Jim.
My, don't you sound serious, though.
I don't want to be serious. All I want to do is be close beside you.
Say, there's a road somewhere ahead that cuts off about 10 miles. Country road. I'll have to watch for it.
Remember the first day we met, Jim? That little country road?
Mm-hmm. Wasn't far from Lee House.
You just walked down that road from the Hendersons, and when I came along, you were poking at some rocks with a long stick, and I couldn't imagine what you were doing.
Oh, hey there, young lady. You like to see something?
See what?
Well, come here and find out. A whole nest of them, down in this crevice in the rocks.
Nest of what?
Well, come and see. They won't bite you.
Oh, no, you tell me. I'd rather not look. That rattling...
That does give them away. Well, it's a mama snake and, oh, I don't know how many chillin', in the nicest snake house you ever saw. Big fellas, too.
Oh, then you let them alone before they come out.
Oh, they'd be as scared of you as you'd be of them. Well, say, you live around here somewhere?
Yes, but I must go now.
Oh, no, wait a minute. I'm Jim Brandt, architect over at the Henderson's place. Been adding that new wing and rebuilding the stable.
I heard about it.
Where do you live?
At the Lee House.
I've been on lots of walks around here, but I've never seen you before. How come?
I don't often go out.
Say, you must be Mr. Lee's daughter, huh? Or has he got a daughter?
I really can't talk with you, Mr. Brandt. I've got to hurry home.
Oh.
Goodbye.
Oh, hey, Miss Lee. Maybe I'll see you around here again sometime.
First time we met. Remember?
You know, you were mighty strange that day.
I was afraid.
Afraid? Afraid of what?
Oh, I don't know. I guess because all the days were so full of him. Like the day he disappeared.
What do you mean, Anna?
He went sailing alone that day. Then suddenly the squall blew up, the wind and the waves, and nobody ever saw him again.
Annabelle.
Yes, Jim?
Annabelle Lee.
Huh?
Annabelle.
I didn't hear what
Annabelle.
You said.
I didn't.
But you did. You said my name.
Oh, you were just half asleep, that's all. Hey, what's that? Oh, doggone it, Anna. We got a flat tire.
Don't stop, Jim. Don't stop here.
We have to. I can't ride the rim.
But there's nothing to fix it with, Jim. Let's go on, please. I don't care about the tire.
Anna, what's the matter? You think I'm going to ruin a perfectly good... Hey, look. There's a little house up there. I'll bet he's got a jack. Hey, up there. Darling, don't look like that.
What's the matter?
Hello. Sorry to bother you. Have you got a jack I can borrow? Flat tire.
Sure. Hey, son. Go get the jack out of the car.
Yeah, you see, Anna, we'll have it fixed in no time. Oh, darling, don't look peeved.
You people headed for the turnpike?
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And you're going the wrong way. Shortcut's back about a mile.
Oh, you mean we're past it?
Well, how do there, ma'am? Didn't see you at first.
How'd you do?
I don't guess you remember me. I come over and helped your husband's man, Jameson, fix the gardens this spring.
Jim.
It's too bad he's lost in that squall, Miss Lee. A fine gentleman, Mr. Jonathan was. It grieved us all to see your husband go like that.
Jim, you've turned back. You're taking me home.
You were Jonathan's wife, Anna.
Don't take me back. I didn't lie to you, Jim. I was going to tell you.
When? After we got married? After...
No, I was going to tell you tonight. That second time I saw you after Jonathan disappeared, you asked my name. Even then you thought I was his daughter and something wouldn't let me say I was his wife. It was so much older, Jim, nearly 20 years.
How long were you married?
4 years. 4 dreadful years. I never loved him.
Anna.
I can't help it. He kept me like a prisoner in that gloomy house, watching me every minute. Oh, Jim, I do love you. Don't take me back.
It's all right, Anna. Don't get upset. Just be quiet for a few minutes. What's the matter? What are you looking back for?
Something's following us. I can feel it, Jim.
On this lonely road?
You're sorry you ever came.
Anna, stop it.
Say you're not sorry. Say you forgive me for deceiving you.
I do forgive you.
Then everything's all right, Jim. Don't hate me.
Oh, Anna, no. Let's not talk about it. Not now.
Yes, let's forget. Let's talk of something else. Look, it's beginning to rain. Night's come.
Yes. Listen to it on the roof. Seems to be saying your name. There's a poem written about you. Know that?
Yes.
Pose. I used to know it by heart. It was many and many a year ago in a kingdom by the sea
that a maiden there lived. Whom you may know.
That's it.
By the name of Annabel Lee. And this maid, she lived with no other thought than to love and be loved by me.
Say, you know it too.
Heard it a million times. I know it all, every syllable.
Annabel.
Jim, listen.
What?
It was many and many a year ago in a kingdom by the sea.
Jim, look.
What is it?
On the road in the lightning. A man in the rain.
And it's not anybody.
But you don't know. He was in the house from that first day he disappeared. I could hear him even before that. Out at sea, calling my name.
Oh, Anna, you've got to stop this.
But, Jim...
You're just imagining it, I tell you. You're...
Jim, I've got to tell you. I can't go on without telling you the truth.
What truth?
I killed him.
Anna.
I killed Jonathan. I killed my husband.
What are you saying?
Now you know. Now you can take me back to Lee House. You can take me back home, back to him.
Jonathan Lee is dead. And our story begins one night a few months later when Anna, a young woman who has lived in seclusion for 4 years at Lee House, is to be married to Jim Brandt, a young architect. Jameson, the old caretaker, sees her off in the station wagon. And as Anna and Jim drive along, she confesses that she was Jonathan's wife, that she herself murdered him. Her mind is distraught with a terrible fear that the dead man is somehow among the undead, that he is waiting for her.
Oh, Anna, I don't believe you. What are you saying?
That I killed him. I planned to kill him.
No, you couldn't have.
I had to tell you, because Jim, somehow he's not dead. You said the dead only live in somebody's mind. And they do. But they also live beyond the mind.
Oh, Anna, please.
That's why I couldn't wait to tell you. Calmly and sanely in the light of day. Jonathan's waiting somewhere for
me. Listen. Now, Anna, listen.
Don't you see, Jim? I thought I could run away from him. I thought I could send him out to sea and He'd never come back again.
Here, I'm going to stop the car.
Oh, no. Jim, please, no. If you loved me, take me home.
And tell me why. Why on earth did you do this?
I had to.
Tell me why.
That poem you mentioned. You used to say it to me. You used to love it. I'll hear him till I die. His voice droning out the words. Sometimes, Jim, he'd lie awake and I'd hear him whispering it over and over. I could see, mournful and sad. When I started working in the village at the library, 5 years ago that was, he used to come in and ask for Beau. At first I thought he was just a lonely old man, lonely because his wife was dead. That day, late in October, he asked me if I'd take the job of cataloging his library. It was right after my mother died. I was alone. He used to come in that big, dark room and ask to help. He used to say, "You're working too hard, Annabelle. Come for a sail with me." I went once or twice. He'd look at me with a strange kind of laughter in his eyes. Then he asked me to marry him. He asked me a dozen times. At last I did. And then 4 years in that house with the sea always pounding, the wind crying in the cold.
But what did he do, Anna? What could have made you...
He was going to kill me. Just as he killed the first Mrs. Lee.
What? He murdered her?
Oh, Jim. I had to do it. From the day I married him, I wasn't allowed out of that house. Except when he went along. That afternoon I met you. He'd gone for a sail, and I planned to run away.
Yes, you did have a suitcase, I remember.
But when I met you, I was sure you were one of his spies, so I had to go back again. That night, I went to his room. He was sitting in the huge chair by the fire. He looked up and smiled that grim smile.
Did you want something, Annabelle?
Jonathan, you loved me once. I had pity for you once, if not love. Oh, listen to me, please.
But you've said it all before, hundreds of times.
I couldn't say it enough, Jonathan. Please, please let me go. I'll do anything you say if you'll only let me go.
But, my dear, when I met you, didn't my money please your eye? Isn't it enough to have that?
It wasn't your money, Jonathan. It was pity for you. Only pity. I thought it was love.
Where is your pity now? No, Annabelle. I couldn't let you go. You'd find pity for another man and grow to believe that you loved him, too. How could I bear such a thing to happen? No. You see, your pity, as you call it, is only for me. Until the day you die.
What do you mean? Jonathan, what do you mean?
Soon, I'll let you go, Annabelle. Someday soon, you must go for a sail with me.
I screamed and ran from him. My mind was sick with terror. What was I to do? The house was like a prison, and everywhere I turned were shadows and gloom, and Jonathan was part of it all. But I had one friend, and he'd come to me when I needed him most.
Miss Anna, don't turn on the light.
Jameson, where are you?
Here beside you. I've been waiting in your room because I had to see you without him knowing it.
Oh, Jameson, you've got to help me. I've got to get out of here.
No, Miss Anna. That's what he wants you to do. And that's why I came to stop you from going.
Why?
He'd follow you. He'd find you.
You heard what he said?
I've heard it before. The other Mrs. Lee. She begged him to let her go. Time and again she begged him. And one day, she took a boat from the cove.
He said she was lost in the sea.
Yes, Miss Anna. But Mr. Jonathan followed in a skiff, and then she never came back. He murdered her.
Jameson.
It's the truth.
I believe you. I do.
Then wait and plan. I'll help, but he mustn't know about it. Tomorrow, we'll talk tomorrow. if he goes sailing again.
Sailing? You're right, Jameson. I won't run away. I know now what I have to do. I know now what I must do. So that night, I made my plan. The next day, he did go sailing. And that was when I caught them. With a little cord noose I made myself. I lay on the rocks for a long time, looking down, waiting till I could get the cord over their heads.
Caught what?
The rattlesnakes you showed me that day.
Yeah.
I caught them and took them down to the cove in a box. And that night, I put them in his boat in a coil of rope. I left them there.
Oh, Anna, how terrible.
The next day, he went sailing again. He didn't see them at first. The motion of the boat and a sharp sting on his leg. And waiting in the dark, I could picture him fighting, drawing back, turning loose of the boom, climbing out of the pit. And the squall came. And he was gone.
Oh, Anna, what are we going to do?
But I had to, Jim.
And it wasn't because of me.
I'd only seen you once. I didn't know you weren't somebody he'd hired to watch me till I saw you again and again after he was dead. Oh, Jim.
Anna, look out. Hold on. It's a cliff. We're hanging over the edge, Anna. Get out, quick. Here, take my hand. This side, Anna, this side. That was close.
Are you all right?
Yes, I'm all right.
Look, we nearly went over into the sea. Golly, we'd both have been killed.
Jim! Jim!
What, Anna?
We're back where we started. There's the house and the cliff.
What?
You brought me back.
Anna, you know I didn't.
Jim, look. Who is it, Jim? Yonder on the road.
I don't know.
It's Jonathan. He's walked up from the sea. Oh, let me go, Jim. Let me go.
Oh, it's only some man. Anna, come back here. Come back.
Hey, down there. What's the trouble?
Quick, man. Help me stop her.
Oh, where'd she go?
I'm Jameson.
We had an accident, Jameson. She's gotten some crazy notion in her head about a ghost. Look, she's running across the lawn.
Down to the sea path. Hurry. Miss Anna. Miss Anna. It's me, Jameson.
Oh, Jameson. It's you. It's you.
Oh, Anna, where were you running to?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know.
Oh, my darling. You frightened us nearly to death.
It was only me on the road, man.
I thought I...
She's shivering, sir. Here, take my coat, Miss Anna. It's Providence that brought you back tonight.
Why, Jameson?
There's nothing to say, Jameson. Jim, take me to the house.
But when Jonathan sailed away that day, the snakes weren't in the boat. I took them out. You see, he could have heard their rattles. And anyway, sir, I couldn't have Miss Anna do such a thing.
Jameson, you mean...
I couldn't have her do it, sir. When rightly, the job was mine.
What you're trying to say...
It was my daughter Amy I was thinking of. How Mr. Jonathan drove her to love him like she did. And how he would smile at her in that laughing way. So that she'd jump from the rocks here down to the sea.
Then that was why...
So, that day, before he went for his last sail, I cut the rigging ropes. And when the wind took the canvas strong, as it does when you ride the swells, they snapped. I stood here on the cliff and watched the boom fly free, and down he went beneath it.
Oh, Jim.
How could I watch him murder you, Miss Anna, as he'd murdered my Amy?
Oh, you're free of it, Anna, now. Don't you see? It was only the fear in your mind.
I've got a fire going in the library, Miss Anna.
I'll take her in, Jameson.
I'll go see if I can get your car off the cliff.
Oh, no, Jameson. Let it alone. We don't care about the car.
Oh, but you two can be on your way again when the rain blows over.
Come along in, Anna. You're cold now. Here, pull the coat around you.
He did it for me, Jim.
Are you all right now?
Now I am. Jim, look. What's Jameson doing?
He's climbing in the car.
Stop him, Jim.
What? He started the motor.
But the car is hanging over the edge of the rocks. Jim, stop him. It's toppling. It's toppling over the cliff. Oh, Jim, how awful. It went over the cliff.
Down to the sea in the cove.
He did it all for me.
And for me too, darling.
But he's made everything all right, Anna. He's made everything all right.
Shadows and stillness, mystery weaves a spell of strangest fascination, charging the mind with doubts and fears. For mystery is a strange companion, a living memory in the haunting hour.
Hour on Tuned to Yesterday, episode 26 in that syndicated series, first heard in 1945. This is an hour of horror on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Next, two broadcasts of Sleep No More, a program featuring short stories read by master storyteller Nelson Olmsted. He got his start in radio on some interesting programs in 1935, but had his own series on radio as early as 1939, where it was simply just him reading a story. He received national attention on the World's Greatest Stories series on the NBC Blue Network, reading tales from Charles Dickens and Edgar Allan Poe, among others. This next story is called The Monster Cat, heard on NBC in 1956.
For the most wild, yet most homely narrative which I'm about to pen, I neither expect nor solicit belief. Mad indeed would I be to expect it, in a case where my very senses reject their own evidence. Yet mad am I not, and very surely do I not dream. But tomorrow I die, and today I would unburden my soul. From my infancy, I was noted for the docility and humanity of my disposition, and was especially fond of animals. I married a woman of similar disposition, and we lost no opportunity of procuring pets of the most agreeable kind. We had birds, goldfish, a fine dog, rabbits, a small monkey, and a cat. This latter was a remarkably large and beautiful animal, entirely black and sagacious to an astonishing degree. In speaking of his intelligence, my wife made frequent allusions to the ancient popular notion which regarded all black cats as witches in disguise. Not that she was ever serious upon this point, and I mention the matter at all for no better reason than that it happens just now to be remembered. Pluto, this was the cat's name, was my favorite pet. But I grew, day by day, more moody, more irritable, more regardless of the feelings of others. My disease grew upon me. For what disease is like alcohol? One night, returning home much intoxicated, I fancied the cat avoided my presence. I seized him when, in his fright at my violence, he inflicted a slight wound upon my hand with his teeth. The fury of a demon instantly possessed me. I took a penknife, grasped the poor beast by the throat, and deliberately cut out one of its eyes. When reason returned with the morning, when I had slept off the fumes of the night's debauch, I experienced a sentiment half of horror, half of remorse. It was at best feeble, and I soon drowned it in wine. The cat slowly recovered. The socket of the lost eye presented its true, frightful appearance, but he no longer appeared to suffer any pain. He went about the house as usual, but, as might be expected, fled in extreme terror at my approach. I had so much of my old heart left as to be at first grieved by the evident dislike,
But this feeling soon gave place to irritation. And then came, as if to my final and irrevocable overthrow, the spirit of perverseness. Who has not 100 times found himself committing a vile or a stupid action for no other reason than because he knows he should not? One morning, in cold blood, I slipped the noose about Pluto's neck and hung it to the limb of a tree. Hung it with the tears streaming from my eyes. Hung it because I knew that it loved me and because I felt it had given me no reasonable offense. Well, that night, I was aroused from sleep by the cry of fire. The curtains of my bed were in flames. The whole house was blazing. It was with great difficulty that my wife, a servant, and myself made our escape. The destruction was complete. The next day, I visited the ruins. The walls, with one exception, had fallen in. This exception was a wall against which had rested the head of my bed. And on this wall, as if graven in bas-relief upon its white surface, was the figure of a gigantic cat with a rope around its neck. My wonder and my terror were extreme. For months, I could not rid myself of this phantasm of a cat. And during this period, there came back into my spirit a half-sentiment that seemed, but was not, remorse. One night, as I sat half-stupefied in a den of more than infamy, my attention was suddenly drawn to some black object. It was a black cat with one eye, a very large cat, fully as large as Pluto, and closely resembling him in every respect, except for an indefinite splotch of white hair covering nearly the whole region of the breast. Upon my touching him, he immediately arose, purred loudly, and rubbed against my hand, and appeared delighted with my notice. It followed me home, where it domesticated itself at once and became immediately a great favorite with my wife. For my own part, I soon found a dislike to it arising within me. This was just the reverse of what I'd anticipated. Gradually, very gradually, I came to look upon it with unutterable loathing. I am almost ashamed to own, yes, even in this felon's cell, I am almost ashamed to own that the terror and horror with which the animal inspired me had been heightened by one of the merest chimeras it would be possible to conceive. The mark of white hair on the cat had been originally very indefinite. But by slow degrees, degrees nearly imperceptible, this mark assumed the rigorous outline of a hideous, of a ghastly thing, of the gallows. And now was I indeed wretched beyond the wretchedness of mere humanity. Evil thoughts became my sole intimates, the darkest and most evil of thoughts. The moodiness of my usual temper increased to a hatred of all things and of all mankind. Well, one day, my wife and I went into the cellar of the old building, which our poverty compelled us to inhabit. The cat followed me down the steep stairs and, nearly throwing me headlong, exasperated me to madness. Uplifting an axe, I aimed a blow at the animal, but it was arrested by the hand of my wife. Goaded by this interference, I buried the axe in her brain. She fell dead upon the spot without a groan. I set myself with entire deliberation to the task of concealing the body. I knew that I could not remove it from the house, either by day or night, without the risk of being observed by neighbors. Many projects entered my mind, until finally I determined to wall it up in the cellar, as the monks of the Middle Ages are recorded to have walled up their victims. In one of the walls was a projection, caused by a false chimney or fireplace, that had been filled up and made to resemble the rest of the cellar. I easily dislodged the bricks, I propped the body against the inner wall, and I relaid the bricks. I prepared a plaster which could not be distinguished from the old, and with this I very carefully went over the new brickwork. When I'd finished, I felt satisfied that the wall did not present the slightest appearance of having been disturbed. My next step was to look for the cat, but it was nowhere to be seen. Thus, for one night at least, since I brought the cat home, I soundly and tranquilly slept. I slept even with the burden of murder upon my soul. The second and third day passed. I breathed as a free man. The monster, in terror, had fled the premises forever. I should behold it no more. My happiness was supreme. Upon the fourth day, a party of the police came very unexpectedly into the house and proceeded to make a rigorous investigation of the premises. I felt no embarrassment whatever. The officers bade me accompany them in their search. At length, for the third or fourth time, they descended into the cellar. My heart beat calmly. I walked the cellar from end to end. The police were thoroughly satisfied and prepared to depart. The glee in my heart was too strong to be restrained. as the party ascended the steps, I said at last, "Gentlemen, I delight to have allayed your suspicions. Oh, by the by, gentlemen, this is a very well-constructed house." In a rabid desire to say something easily, I scarcely knew what I uttered at all.
"I may say an excellently well-constructed house. These walls... Oh, are you going, gentlemen? These walls are solidly put together."
And here, I rapped heavily with a cane upon that very portion of the brickwork behind which stood the corpse of my wife. No sooner had the reverberation of my blow sunk into silence than I was answered by a voice from within the tomb, by a cry at first muffled and broken, and then quickly swelling into one long, loud, and continuous scream, utterly inhuman, a howl, a wailing shriek, half of horror and half of triumph, such as might have arisen only out of hell. I staggered to the opposite wall. For one instant, the party on the stairs remained motionless. In the next, a dozen stout arms were toiling at the wall. It fell bodily. The corpse, already greatly decayed and clotted with gore, stood erect before the eyes of the spectators. Upon its head, with red extended mouth and solitary eye of fire, sat the hideous beast whose craft had seduced me into murder and whose informing voice had consigned me to the hangman. I had walled up the monster within the tomb.
Sleep No More, on Tuned to Yesterday from 1956 on NBC. We wrap up this hour of horror now with another broadcast of Sleep No More called Night, an adaptation of Ray Bradbury's story published in 1946.
There was Christian Bovey who said, "There is great beauty in going through life without anxiety or fear. Half our fears are baseless, the other half discreditable." This is Nelson Olmsted. Recently, in my reading, I came across a book of short stories that I thought was exceptionally original. It was entitled Dark Carnival, and the author is Ray Bradbury. Today, I'd like to bring you what, in my opinion, is one of the best stories from this collection. It's a powerful tale written, you may be surprised to discover, about yourself. And it's entitled The Night. Child in a small town. You are, to be exact, 8 years old, and it's growing late at night, late for you, accustomed to bedding in at 9 or 9:30. Once in a while, perhaps, begging Mom or Dad to let you stay up later to hear Sam and Henry on that strange radio that's popular in this year of 1927. But most of the time, you're in bed and snug at this time of night. It's a warm summer evening. You and your mother are all alone at home in the warm darkness of summer. Finally, just before it's time for Mrs. Singer to close her store, Mother tells you, "Run and get a pint of ice cream, and be sure she packs it tight." You ask if you can get a scoop of chocolate ice cream on top because you don't like vanilla, and Mother agrees. You clutch the money and run barefooted over the warm evening cement sidewalk under the apple trees and oak trees toward the store. The town is so quiet and far off. You can only hear the crickets sounding in the spaces beyond the hot indigo trees that hold back the stars. When you get back with the ice cream, you find Mom still ironing. She looks hot and irritated, but she smiles just the same. "When will Dad be home from the lodge meeting?" "Oh, about 11:30 or 12, Mother replies. She takes the ice cream to the kitchen, divides it, giving you your special portion of chocolate. She dishes out some for herself, and the rest is put away for Skipper and your father when they come. Skipper is your brother. He is your older brother. He's 12 and healthy, and he is allowed to stay up later than you. You sit enjoying the ice cream. You're at the core of the deep, quiet summer night. Your mother and yourself, and the night all around this small house on this small street. You both sit there listening to the summer silence. The dark is pressed down by every window and door. There is no sound because the radio needs a new battery. And you've played all the Knickerbocker Quartet records and Al Jolson and 2 Black Crow records to exhaustion. So, you just sit on the hardwood floor by the door and look out into the dark, pressing your nose against the screen until the flesh of its tip is molded into small, dark squares. I I wonder where your brother is. Mother says after a while. He should be home by now. It's almost 9:30. He'll be here, you say, knowing very well that he will be. Well, Mom sits down a moment, then stands up, goes to the door, and calls. You listen to her calling and calling. Over and over, the calling goes out into the summer warm dark and never comes back. The echoes pay no attention. And as you sit on the floor, a coldness that is not ice cream and not winter and not a part of summer's heat goes through you. You notice Mom's eyes sliding, blinking, the way she stands undecided and is nervous. All of these things, she opens the screen door. Stepping out into the night, she walks down the steps and down the front sidewalk under the lilac bush. You listen to her moving feet. She calls again. Silence. The screen door opens and Mother says, "Come on, Short, we'll take a walk." "Where to?" "Just down the block, come on. You better put on your shoes, though. You'll catch cold." No, I'll be all right." You take her hand. Together you walk down St. James Street. You smell lilacs and blossoms, fallen apples lying crushed and odorous in the deep grass. Underfoot, the concrete is still warm, and the crickets are sounding louder against the darkening dark. You reach the corner, turn, and walk toward the ravine. "I wish your father was home," says Mother. Her large hand tightens around your small one. "Just wait till I get that boy. I'll spank him within an inch of his life." A razor strap hangs in the kitchen for this, but you doubt Mother will carry out her promise. Now you walk another block and are standing by the holy black silhouette of the German Baptist Church. In back of the church, 100 yards away, the ravine begins. You can smell it. It's a dark sewer, rotten foliage, thick green odor. It's a wide ravine that cuts and twists across the town, a jungle by day, a place to let alone at night, Mother has often declared. You are only 8 years old. You know little of death, fear or dread. Death is the waxen effigy in the coffin when you were 6 and Grandfather passed away, looking like a great fallen vulture in his casket, silent, withdrawn. No more to tell you how to be a good boy. No more to comment succinctly in politics. Death is your little sister one morning, when you awaken at the age of 7, look into her crib and see her staring up at you with her blind, blue, fixed and frozen stare until the men came in with a small wicker basket to take her away. Death is when you stand by her high chair 4 weeks later and suddenly realize she will never be in it again, laughing and crying and making you jealous of her because she was born. That is death. But this is more than death. This is the ravine. Here and now, down there in that pit of jungle's blackness, is suddenly all the evil you will ever know, evil you will never understand. Down there, in the huddled shadow, among thick trees and frail vines, lives the odor of decay. Here at this spot, civilization ceases, reason ends, and a universal evil takes over. You realize you're alone, you and your mother. Her hand trembles. Her hand trembles. Why? Your belief in your private world is shattered. Is she, too, doubtful? But she is bigger and stronger, more intelligent than yourself, isn't she? Does she, too, feel that intangible menace, that groping out of darkness, that crouching below? The essential impact of life's loneliness crushes your beginning to tremble body. Mother is alone, too. She can't look to the sanctity of marriage, the protection of her family's love. She can't look to the United States Constitution or the city police. She can't look anywhere in this very instant, save into her heart. And there she'll find nothing but uncontrollable repugnance and a will to fear. In this instance, it is an individual problem seeking an individual solution. You must accept being alone and work on from there. You swallow hard, cling to her. Mother advances down the path into the primeval jungle. Your voice trembles. "Mom, Skip's all right. Skip's all right. He's all right." Mother's voice is strange, high. "He always comes through here. I tell him not to, but those darn kids, they come through here anyway.
Some night he'll come through. He'll never come out again. Never come out again. That could mean anything. Tramps, criminals, darkness, accident. Most of all, death. Alone in the universe. There are a million small towns like this all over the world. Each as dark, as lonely, each as removed, as full of shuddering and wonder. Oh, the vast, swelling loneliness of them. The secret, damp ravines of them. Life is a horror lived in them at night. When at all sides sanity, marriage, children, happiness is threatened by an ogre called Death. Mother raises her voice into the dark.
Skip! Skipper! Skip! Skipper!
Suddenly, both of you realize that there is something wrong. Something very wrong. You listen intently and realize what it is. The crickets have stopped chirping. Silence is complete. Never in your life a silence like this one. One so utterly complete. Why should the crickets cease? Why? What reason? They have never stopped before, not ever. Unless something is going to happen. It's as if the whole ravine is tensing, bunching together its black fibers, drawing in power from all about sleeping countryside for miles and miles. In 10 seconds now, something will happen. Something will happen. The crickets keep their truce. The stars are so low, you can almost brush the tinsel. There are swarms of them, hot and sharp. Growing, growing, the silence. Growing, growing, the tenseness. Oh, it's so dark, so far away from everything. And then, way off across the ravine.
Okay, Mom. Coming, Mother.
And again.
Hi, Mom. Coming, Mom.
And then the quick scuttering of tennis shoes padding down through the pit of the ravine as 3 kids come dashing and giggling. Your brother Skipper, Chuck Redmond, and Augie Bart running and giggling. The stars suck up like stung antenna of 10 million snails. The crickets sing. The darkness pulls back, startled, shocked, angry. Pulls back, losing its appetite at being so rudely interrupted as it prepared to feed. As the darkness retreats like a wave on a shore, 3 kids pile out of it, laughing.
Hi, Mom. Hi, George. Hey.
It smells like Skipper, all right. Sweat and grass and his oiled leather baseball glove.
Young man, you're going to get a licking,
declares Mother. Puts away her fears instantly. You know she will never tell anybody of it, ever. It will be in her heart, though, for all time, as it's in your heart for all time. You walk home to bed in the late summer night. You're glad Skipper's alive, very glad. For a moment, you thought, far off in the dim, moonlit country, a train goes rushing along, and it whistles like a lost metal thing, nameless and running. You go to bed, shivering beside your brother, listening to that train whistle, and thinking of a cousin who lives way out in the country, a cousin who died of pneumonia late at night years and years ago. You smell the sweat of Skip beside you. It's magic. You stop trembling. You hear footsteps outside the house on the sidewalk as Mother's turning out the light. A man clears his throat in a way you recognize. Mom says, "That's your father." It is. Short story, The Night, as told by Nelson Armstrong. And now a closing word. Well, this story is included, as I said, in Ray Bradbury's excellent collection of short stories, Dark Carnival. Bradbury is one of our new writers in this country, and in my opinion, one of the most original. The music today was arranged and played by Lou Webb. This is Nelson Armstrong saying goodbye and good reading.
Sleep No More, on Tuned to Yesterday from 1956 on NBC. And that wraps up this hour of horror on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great shows from radio's golden era. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for tuning in.